Suddenly, Lois Fong was on him like a gold lame anaconda, wrapped around him like the long golden evening gown was wrapped around her, which is to say, quite snugly. Lois smooched him mercilessly, causing Mushu's to have to steady himself against the host station. Just as I was thinking, well, she's going to do it. She's going to give him the old razzmatazz right up against the wall. Eddie twisted out of her clutches, kissed her quick on the temple, and patted her bottom to see her back into the cocktail lounge, where she wiggled in a most disappointed and unsatisfied manner, very much on the pout. Eddie looked up at me and grinned like a complete idiot, then quick-stepped down the hall to join me. "What's the haps, Paps?" he said, still grinning. "Don't act like that just didn't happen. And you got lipstick over your goofy mug." I handed him a handkerchief I kept in my overcoat, and he wiped away as we headed out. "I know," he said. "Can you believe it? Ever since you told her to buzz off, she's been on me like white on rice." "In my defense," I said, "you also told her to buzz off."
"Like I said, the magic words," said Eddie.
"Guys always tell me that dames love that, but I don't believe them. But now, I'm not an expert, but I do not think it works with all dames. Still, I do not want to stand between you and your good fortune. I can handle this if you want to go tend to Lois's wants and or needs."
"Nah, you can't handle this. And I don't want to press my luck. Besides, if she puts the chill on me again, I'll just tell her to buzz off again."
I nodded. "You are an operator, Mushu's. That is what you are." As we made our way down Grant and swung a left onto Pine, I said, "I got the money for Uncle Mao."
"Uncle Ho," Mushu's corrected.
"And good, because that's where we're going." "Oh," I said. "Yeah, I know that." I did not know that. Soon we were in an alley with less than adequate lighting, but with more than its share of garbage odor and creatures scampering in the dark.
"How's your foot?" Eddie asked.
"It's fine. Hurts a little, but I am distracted by other matters."
"You okay without a cane?"
"It would appear so," said I. Before I could elaborate, we were knocking on the steel door, and Uncle Mao let us in. Eddie said some nonsense to him in Cantonese, and then said to me,
"Give him the money."
I did, and the old guy counted it, then led us through the dimly lit opium den to the bunk where we stashed Pookie. He pulled back the curtain, and there lay Pookie O'Hara, curled up like a little piggy on his side, naked except for a pink silk kimono that was too small for him in all dimensions. There was more of Pookie than I ever cared to see, and if I had not spent my whole day strengthening my resolve by packing and unpacking a stiff, I would probably have blown lunch at the sight of the cop. Uncle Mao said something, and Mu translated.
"It's easier to take care of him and clean him up this way."
"Fine," I said, "but we'll have to take his clothes for my plan to work." Then I told them both the plan. I talked and paused, to give Mushu's a chance to translate for Uncle Mao. We would get Pookie right to the edge of never waking up. Then we would drive him and Sal's body out into the country somewhere, where there are woods, but we would make a note of where we put them. We would lay it out so it looked like Pookie off sail. Then we'd give Pookie one last dose, pour some liquor at him so if anyone found him, they'd think he was drunk. Then we'd call the cops, anonymous-like, say we saw two guys fighting by the side of the road, and we think one of them is hurt. When the cops showed up, there would be Pookie, out drunk, and Sal still dead, but it would appear at the hands of Pookie O'Hara. When I finished and Moo finished just behind me in Chinese, they both looked at me.
"So it looks like Pookie killed him," Mu asked.
"Yeah.
With a snake."
Uncle Mao said something.
Mu said something back.
I realized I might not have thought the plan through as completely as I should have.
"So we gotta make it look like Sal is killed in a way that Pookie would kill him."
"How would that be? Beat to death?"
"I don't know. Wake Pookie up and ask him."
So I smacked Pookie lightly on the cheeks to wake him, the way you bring a drunk to who has dropped his head in the bar, but it didn't work. So I pushed the cop over on his back and his head lolled to the side. Then I gave him a good slap. "Pookie, how would you croak a guy?" I said. To Moo, I said,
"What about Pookie's gun?
We can blast Sal thoroughly, covering up the snake glue." Uncle Mao said something. Moo translated.
"He says he sold the gun. You're going to have to kill Pookie."
I resumed trying to get Pookie's attention with the flat of my hand. Smack. "Give it up, Pookie, do you hear me? How would you offer, guy? Smack!"
Moose said, "Maybe we can just find a way to destroy his mind. Make him forget everything, so when he wakes up, he just drools and has to eat strained peas and stuff that you don't have to chew.
Yeah, that would be the humane thing, I said.
Good point, Moose said. He stepped in, gave Pookie a smack. Come on, Pookie. You're gonna ice a guy. How do you do it?
Don't say ice, I said. I have unpleasant memories.
Sorry, said Moo.
Uncle Mao made a throat-cutting motion behind Moo's back, pointed to Pookie.
Smack.
My turn.
Give it up, Pookie. How do you do it?
Smack.
What's your angle, Flatfoot?
Smack. But Pookie just gave a little smile, and even in the dim light of the opium den, I could see his cheeks were burning red from being slapped, but he was not feeling it.
Mao made the gesture of putting a gun to his head and pulling the trigger.
Smack.
How would you kill a guy, Pookie?
Smack.
Apparently I had some residual anger at Pookie for attempting to ventilate Lone Jones with his .45 for the crime of being black, so I wasn't as concerned with getting him to talk as I was with smacking him around. Mao tied an imaginary noose, hanged himself to show his opinion.
Smack.
I hit him again. Then Pookie's big paw came up off the little mattress and caught my hand.
No, he said, his voice sounding like he was gargling marbles. I wouldn't hurt nobody, never, he said.
Then his hand fell limp, his eyes rolled back, and he was off to dreamland.
Well, you ruined him, Mushu said. Now we're going to have to kill him.
Big grin on Uncle Mao, who gestured a dozen arrows hitting in the chest, made the noise as each one hit, then mime croaking, his tongue hanging out.
We're not going to kill him, I said.
Smack.
He's not going to tell you anything.
I know, I said, but I'm probably not going to get the chance to do this again.
Good point, said Moo, who took that opportunity to give Pookie a couple of good swats for luck.
Tell your uncle to knock him out. We'll need some time to figure it out. Let's go get Milo's cab and pick up Sal.
As we walked to the door, Mushu said some stuff to his uncle, and as the old guy gave his answer, it did not take an abacus for me to figure out, he gave us 2 more days. Then there was a long exchange in Chinese, and I got the feeling that the meter was running as the old guy talked. Mushu turned to me.
He says he can help us catch the mamba.
I don't have any more money.
He knows that. He says he'll do it, but he gets to keep the snake.
We paid a lot of folding fodder for that snake. Mushu's gave me the inscrutable eyebrow that only Chinese guys can give you. I whispered,
"You think he can do it?"
Mu nodded.
"You know he's only asking because I'm family. He doesn't really need our permission."
"Fine," I said.
Uncle Ho said something. "He'll need some rats. There's a whole goddamn alley full of rats on the other side of this door."
Uncle Ho shook his head, babbled some bullshit.
"Fresh rats," Mu translated.
"Fine." Then Uncle Ho let us out, and as we walked away, shouted something at Mushu's through the little hatch.
"What'd he say?" I asked.
"He says we should kill Pookie."
"Of course he says that," I said.
"Then we'd have 2 white devil bodies, and Uncle Catfucker would figure a way to extort us over it."
"That's probably true," said Mushu's. "Let's deal with Sal first."
We got the cab from Milo, prying it away from him with a sawbuck and a promise. But when Mushu's and I got back to Sal's and I opened the back door, Sal's body was not there. The crate, the ice, all of it gone.
"You locked the door?"
Eddie asked.
"Yep." "Anyone else got keys?"
"Just me and Sal. He gives Benny, the fill-in guy, his keys on my nights off. And I had both pairs." I looked around the joint, took a peek into the front room, which looked like a dark, empty bar. Smelled of sour beer and cigarettes.
"So you think someone broke in, moved the body to another part of the bar, then relocked the door on the way out?"
said Moo.
"Seems fishy."
He had a point.
"You have a point," I said.
Mushu shrugged.
"Well, that was easy. Can you take the taxi back to Milo, drop me at the club? Lois will probably still be there."
I wanted to say no, that I needed more time to be flummoxed by the situation, that I would like to maybe panic and yell and scream a little. But Eddie has been a good pal. And Lois Fong is a dish indeed, so I said sure. By the time I got Milo's cab back to him and endured the lecture on the hardship I'd caused him, the sun was busting up pink over the East Bay. Even the Tenderloin looked like a dream town in that light, like one of those Max Parrish paintings they have behind the bar at the Palace Hotel, where skinny blonde kids lounge around in towels, like they're any second going to take a swim. I could have used 40 to 100 winks in Dreamtown myself, but instead of heading home, I limped over to the 5 and Dime on Polk Street. The place smelled like comic books and coffee and cedar chips from the cages back in the pet section, which reminded me I needed to buy some rats. A bored, round redhead in cat glasses at the register said good morning as I passed by the sundries counter, and I nodded good morning right back at her. I felt a smile coming on as I was rounding the corner into the diner section, anticipating feasting my eyes on the beauteous cheese. But instead there was only Phil, the skinny, scruffy fry cook, standing at the counter with a coffee pot in hand, lording over 2 guys at the counter with their hats pulled down like they were hiding from an angry preacher. No Stilton. I took a seat down from the browbeaten guys.
"We got 2 things today," said Phil. "Coffee, scrambled eggs with bacon and white toast, and just coffee."
"Can I get my bacon crispy?" I asked, trying to maybe open up the conversation a little, but
"you can get it the way it comes out, and the toast might be cold."
"Coffee, please," I said. Phil spun a cup, no saucer, onto the counter, and sloshed some coffee mostly into it. "Stilton around?"
"Tilly? Nah. Didn't show up today and didn't call, neither."
"What about the other one, Myrtle?"
"Also AWOL. It's just me. So it's scrambled and bacon. You don't like it? Take a hike. None of that run a cow through a windmill on a mattress, extra go-juice crap."
"That a dish?
How the hell should I know? Sometimes I think those dizzy broads were just making stuff up to make life hard for me. Not anymore. Today I'm running this place the way it should be. You'll get breakfast the way I cook it, and you'll like it or you can starve."
"You remind me of my ma." He started to walk away.
"Hey, just coffee is fine," I said. He stopped.
"So you know where they might be, your waitresses?"
"They were going on some big to-do this weekend. Moonlighting. Make some extra money like they need it. It gets busy in here. They make extra tips. You know what I get?"
I shook my head.
"I get squat. And then they take a powder on me. Well, I hope they made enough lettuce to hold them over, because when they get back, they're both fired."
"What if something happened to them?" I said, thinking, "what if something happened to them?"
"Nothing happened except they had too much fun. They're probably just home sleeping it off."
"Stilton hasn't been home." For the first time since I came in, the anger ran out of his eyes.
"That's right, you were in here to see her the other day."
"Yeah," I said, and the scruff must have seen something in my mug, because he put the coffee pot down on the burner and came back.
"Maybe she stayed over at Myrtle's slumber party, you know, dames. Myrtle ain't answering her phone, but that don't mean..."
"You got an address?"
"In the back. I'll get it for you."
I'd go see her. In a while. I needed to eat, shower, and sleep first. When Phil got back, I ordered some scrambled eggs and cold toast. I wolfed them down. Phil didn't charge me. I went to the retail side of the 5 and Dime and bought some rats. Chapter 13. Rats. When I finally limped up the stairs to my building, dog-tired and ready to collapse, the kid was sitting on the landing.
"What's in the bag?" the kid asked.
"Rats."
"No, it ain't."
I opened the bag, a normal paper grocery bag, doubled. I showed him. Inside, 6 white rats, looking confused, scurried around in some cedar chips.
"Got any brown ones?"
"Nope, just white." The kid shrugged.
"I guess they're okay. Can I have one?"
"I need you to watch them." I set the rat bag on the stoop by him. "Put them in a box or something. They can't chew out of easy. Can you do that? It's a paying job."
"I suppose."
He gave me the skeptical squint, like he smelled a rat.
"You in some kind of jam? You on the lam like some kind of stinking drifter?"
"Nah, I'm fine."
"You sure? A couple of goons was here looking for you."
"Yeah?" I said, "tell me."
"Yeah," said the kid. "Couple of mugs in black suits. Looked like their moms dressed them alike for church. Sunglasses like they was blind."
"So what did you tell him?"
"What am I, a squealer? Told him you didn't live here, and I never heard of you. Told him I've been sitting here since 38, and if there's a guy called Sammy around, I'd know him, and I don't."
"I didn't tell them nothing, the dirty marimbas." "A marimba is a musical instrument, kid, like a xylophone."
"No, it ain't. You're a stinking liar."
"Kid, when you learn a new word, you can run it by me, see if it's legit. You know, the usage. My ma was an English teacher, so I got the skinny on vocabulary and so on."
"I don't need to know that. I only say other stuff because you get jumpy when I call them cocksuckers."
Oh, well, yeah, that's true. Thanks, I guess.
Right. So I tells these xylophone cocksuckers that I ain't never heard of you. And if they don't scram, I'm gonna get my Uncle Bert from upstairs, and he'll blast them with his .45, cause he doesn't go for strangers asking me stuff, cause he's a cop.
And is he? I perked up a little, not in a good way. A cop in the building?
Nah, I ain't got an Uncle Bert. I was just yanking their chains.
Didn't they see my name on the mailbox? My building has 6 brass mailboxes in the hall.
They were headed that way, so that's when I made like I'm gonna go get Uncle Bert to blast him. So they took off.
Good job, kid. I reached into my folding money and peeled off a buck. Here, I need you to keep a lookout today. You see these guys coming, don't wait for them to get here. Run up and wake me up. Watch my rats.
A whole buck?
The kid's eyes got as big as coffee cups.
What's your angle?
These are bad guys is all, and stay here. Don't go wandering off to the pictures or to get ice cream. You get hungry, come up to my place and grab something, but be quiet. Wake me up when the church rings noon. Got it? The bell at St. Peter and Paul's down in Washington Square was the kid's watch. I figured these mooks had already been here today. They weren't coming back before lunchtime, and I had nothing left. The kid squinted at me from under his cap.
You in some kind of pickle? You need a gat?
You can get me a gun?
I might know a guy.
I'll let you know. I was really hoping I didn't need a gun. I'm not afraid of guns. I'd just rather not have to have one. I can shoot. When my foot was on the mend, I passed some time at the shooting range, learning various heaters. But I was in no rush to get into a shootout. I limped up the stairs to my place and fell face first into bed, still in my bartending clothes. And I was out like I was hit with a lead sap. There were no English words on the sign in the shop at Stockton and Pacific, but the Chinese characters translated to Upright House of Harmonious Cabbage. Vegetables were their trade, and they traded a ton of vegetables every day. Mrs. Wong was the matriarch of Harmonious Cabbage, and she did accounts, haggled with farmers and truckers, set up displays along the sidewalk, and barked prices and tales of freshness and flavor at customers from dawn to dusk every day. She was not above sweeping the floor herself when her worthless husband, worthless daughters, and mostly absent sons were too lazy to do it. And that was what she was doing today. Her metal dustpan, most of the black paint worn off, the metal polished by dust, the edge knife sharp after years of scraping the concrete floor, was as wide as a man's shoulders, just narrow enough to fit down the aisles of Harmonious Cabbage, and held 2 quarts of dirt, knocked from root vegetables, fallen leaves, the odd carrot top or tomato stem, peels from sampled oranges, and other detritus of the trade. The pan was full now, so she bumped through the back door to the alley to empty it into one of the trash cans back there. And what did she see but a large gray rat standing up in the top of the can like he owned the joint. Mrs. Wong was accustomed to rats. She was not afraid of rats, and she was, in fact, taking secret joy that this rat was standing so still and not skulking away, because she planned to dump her dustpan and deliver a devastating backhand with its razor edge before the rat had a chance to duck. She made her plan and wound up slowly, letting the dirt trail out of the dustpan in an arch on the bricks. Then she saw it. She was not the only one hunting this casual rat. Beyond the trash can was another predator, a shiny, smooth serpent the color of asphalt rose, as steady as running liquid, until it stood like a dark and elegant dingus of death, taller than her, the rat between them. Fear flowed to action, and she and the mamba struck at once. The phone woke me up. It was Eddie Mushu's.
"Where are my rats?" asked Moo.
"I got 'em. I had to sleep."
"Well, I gotta get to work. Can you take them directly to Uncle Ho?"
"You have to work. Wait, what time is it?"
"Almost 5.
Damn kid was supposed to wake me up."
"I don't have time to get there and back before I have to start setting up. Can you do it?"
"Yeah, maybe. Sure, look, I got some things to do. I will if I can."
"Do that. It's the alley off Pacific.
I know.
Between Powell and..."
"I know. I've been there twice."
"Fine, gotta go."
Moo hung up. I had no idea where to find Ho the cat-fucking uncle, so I figured I'd just wander around the back alleys of Chinatown with my sack of rats until I found him. I wasn't going to give Mushu's the satisfaction of giving me directions, though. I threw open my door, expecting to see the kid there, so I could give him a good ass-chewing, but there at my feet was the bag of rats. Except The kid had put a little cardboard box inside the double bags. There were air holes in it, and it was tied with a string. When I opened the box, it contained 6 white rats, who were lounging in some shredded newspaper, along with a jar lid full of water and a few cornflakes. Oh, and a note. You owe me 2 bits for fixing up your rats. I gotta give the kid credit. He had fixed up my rats in the equivalent of the rat Ritz. But he had also taken a powder on waking me up, which reminded me that he was still a horrible little kid. I could deal with rats later. For now, I had to get Sal's open so nothing looked suspicious. I had Benny, the fill-in guy's number, and I call him and tell him that Sal was off camping, and I had business so I needed him to open the bar and work until closing time. Benny is what we call a high-level day drunk, which means that he is able to go about pulling off a pretty normal life, while always being about half in the bag, except for those times when he goes off on a full bender, at which point he can usually be salvaged from the county jail. He is a pretty young guy, maybe 25, to be so disposed, but he saw some action in Europe during the war, which set him to shaking and screaming sometimes. So he was generally given a pass. Anyway, he was happy to have the work, but didn't have bar keys, so I arranged to meet him at Sal's in half an hour. I was happy to be out of my bartender togs from the previous night, as they were somewhat less than fresh from the evening's goings-on. So after a shower and a shave, I put on the double-breasted gray pinstripe suit I bought for job hunting right after the shipyard closed. I put on a gray linen shirt that I had let steam while I showered, and a black silk tie. I topped it all with a wide-brimmed Stetson fedora I won from a guy in a bar bet, and I was in the wind. A player, an operator, with my sack of rats. I wish the cheese could see me, looking sharp and smelling only slightly of mothballs. The thought of her was a punch under my heart. I tried to shake it off. I just needed to drop off the keys and get back on the trail. A little behind the game, though, because the kid didn't wake me earlier. Benny, the big blonde goof, was waiting for me at the back door of Sal's. I gave him the keys, I kept Sal set, and wished him luck. Told him that he was low on change in the register, but nothing he couldn't work through. Sal walked with most of the cash a lot of the time anyway. The address Phil the fry cook gave me from Myrtle was over near 4th and Mission. It's maybe a 30-minute hoof, but I caught the cable car at Powell and rode it over the hill, so I got off at Market Street only a block away in 10, and I hadn't even shaken up my rats. The building was built in the 20s and had good times and denial written all over it. 10 stories with a pink granite facade and bronze Art Deco inlays of streamlined Greek gods dancing across the cornice like the market crash. The Great Depression and World War II could never happen. I might have started life thinking it was going to be a nice hotel, but now it was cut up into tiny apartments that looked down on a skid row full of broken veterans and low-rent hustlers. Olympus had fallen on tough times. I rang the bell of apartment number 403. The doorbell was one of those twist jobs in the middle of the door, under the peephole, confirming this place was a hotel at one time. It sounded like the bell on a bicycle. And after a minute with no answer or footfalls, I rang it again. I was getting a bad feeling, and I leaned against the wall, took a breath, and tried not to let my worry over the cheese get to me. This was my only lead, and if Myrtle was missing too, maybe Phil the fry cook was right. Maybe they were just 2 girls having too much fun out in the town. I was failing to console myself, and I could even feel my rats getting anxious, when I saw movement in the peephole across the hall. Light and dark, someone looking, then looking away. The sliver of light coming under the door showed a pair of feet that weren't moving. I decided to place my bet, take a chance that what I was seeing was a habit. I gave the bell another twist, then I gave Myrtle's door a good pound. Ah, come on, sis, don't be like that. Ma needs you. She wants you to come home. She ain't got that much time. Another ring. For the love of God, Myrtle, she's dying. I let my voice break on the last bit. It was very fucking sad. My rats wept. And then there was the beautiful click of the nosy neighbor's door behind me. "She's not there," said an older broad, house dress of dying flowers, support stockings and slippers, built like she could play linebacker on the tiny European grandma football team. "She has not come home 2 days now," said Granny Nagurski. "You are a brother?" "Yeah, yeah. But we've been out of contact. It's strange, you know. Some hard feelings, but our ma is sick. She told me mother died 3 years ago. So you can see how it is. Mert told us we were dead to her. You know how that is.
Oh, I know. Do I know? Oh, I know. Many are dead to me. Many, many.
She started to count on her fingers.
No good brother. Dead. No good nephew.
You don't know where she went, do you?
Sorry, Granny. I don't have time for inventory.
She leave you a number? Anything? Honest. Ma just wants to make amends before she passes.
No, she not say. We are not good friends, just neighbor. She is a bit of floozy, you ask me.
Anyone been by besides me?
Yes, she's one young man. Thin, dark hair. He have key. Go in her apartment. Come out with things. Close, maybe.
I felt a chill.
Thin? Dark hair.
Just one?
Just one.
Tall guy? Black suit, white shirt, black fedora, maybe glasses?
No, he's not suit. He's suit with, how you say, like bird.
She made a gesture down below her bottom.
Tails?
A tail coat, like a tux and tails?
Yes, that is it. Tails. Very shiny shoes. Hair slick back.
A little guy in a tux?
I took a breath. At least it wasn't the two guys who were shadowing me. I think he's actor, maybe.
Why do you say that?
Lips is very red, eyes dark, like for stage, maybe.
Oh. Well, we weren't far from the theater district, maybe 5 or 6 blocks. Have you seen this guy in the tux before?
No, Methel is not have men visitors before this. Just skinny man and you.
Then why do you think she's a floozy?
Your sister is dressed like whore.
Sorry.
But she go out showing the this and the that.
She gestured at the this and that on herself, and I started to feel a little brotherly protection for my slutty sister. I hadn't seen my real little sister in years, and maybe I missed the feeling of wanting to pound someone on her behalf. But this Russian or Polish grandma was probably not the best target for my protective wrath. I shrugged it off. Well, thank you. If Myrtle comes in, will you have her call this number and leave a message for Sammy? I wrote down the number for Sal's. I figured Benny would answer and take the message. But better than if I left my own number and trusted the kid to answer. Bronco Nagurski in a house dress took the cable car ticket I wrote it on and looked at it, like I had rubbed color on it.
Okay, she said. I will.
Outside, on the steps of Myrtle's building, I was lighting a coffin nail and trying to figure out what to do next when I spotted a black Chrysler rounding the corner at 4th Street, carrying the two mugs and the black suits from outside Sal's. I knew it was them right away, because I spotted the sunglasses on the one in the passenger seat, and while there was still some daylight left, it being summer, the fog was coming in, and a guy in shades now had better be playing piano in a smoky club or selling pencils on the street, or he would stand out more than somewhat. I didn't know who these mugs were, or if they were following me to Myrtle's building, but I knew where they were going now, and I was suddenly regretting giving my name and number to the Russian granny. Maybe the old broad would mind her own business. I would give 6 to 5 against. I pulled my hat down and hustled my bag of rats down the sidewalk, and I was into an alley before they could get out of the car. I waited, listened. There's still a lot of hustle and flow on Mission Street that time of night. Citizens heading home from work late or out to dinner early. Winos shuffling to the next drink or doorway to bed down in. But Myrtle's building had twin revolving doors that sounded like brush cymbals when they turned. So when I heard the sizzle, I risked a peek around the corner. Yeah, they were inside. And yeah, the trunk of that Chrysler was plenty big enough to hold a crate full of dead Sal on ice. The trickle of water running out below the bumper gave me the idea that Sal might still be relaxing inside. I couldn't figure it. They weren't wise guys, and they definitely weren't cops. Not unless the cops were suddenly snatching stiffs out of locked rooms and neglecting to mention it to the papers. But then I hadn't seen the papers today. Maybe I should check, I thought. Nothing worse than to think you figured an angle on something. Then have someone tell you they read it last week and hint some herb. I figured I'd grab a chronicle once I was out of back alleys, see what I could find out. Not that I expected to open the paper, looking for Stilton, and have a page 2 headline say, "The Cheese Sleeping Off a Bender in a Rat Trap Hotel off Van Ness Avenue." No. If I found her in the paper, she'd either be getting married or she'd have gotten dead. The thought gave me a chill. I pulled my collar up. Wished I'd worn my overcoat. I broke out of the alley in the middle of the block on 3rd Street. The fog off the bay was streaming between the buildings like a scarf through a stripper's legs, leaving everything damp and smelling of sailors' broken dreams. Some rough-looking guys huddled in a doorway nearby, sharing a no-labeled green glass jug of something, probably something sweet and strong, fortified wine. Four guys guaranteed drunk for a buck. There was a sax man sitting on the sidewalk across the street, his sax case laid out before him, playing a blues riff, mournful and wailing, a lull in the traffic. No streetcar ringing for blocks, just the sax, the low growls of the winos, and the hum of wires overhead. The sax man's notes hooked me in a spot right under my jaw, where I was all knotted up with fear and heartbreak and hope, so I limped on over. The sax man stopped playing, adjusted his reed, smiled out of the corner of his eye. "Leg hurt when it's damp, huh?" "Foot," I said, "yeah." The sax man pulled up a pant leg and revealed a dark wooden skin. He knocked on it. "Aches like a bad tooth when the fog's in, and it ain't even there. Landmine." I could see a lone nickel resting in the dirty red velvet of his sax case. I pulled out what cash I had. 36 bucks and some change. I threw in the coins, then looked at the money in my hand and threw in the 10 and the 20. 6 bucks to last me the rest of my life. It would have to do. Small price. He looked in the case, then up at me. "You crazy?" "Probably. That'll get you a room, hot meal or three. I could use a drink. You want to share a drink?" "Early for me. Miles to go," I told him. "But you get out of the cold and have one for me." "Yeah." The sax man tipped his horn. "What you want to hear?" "Whatever you were playing before is fine." "Sad." "Yeah." As he played, I walked my rats up to Market Street, back into the flow of the unbroken. I bought a paper at a news kiosk and tried to wrestle it into the ferry boat fold, tucking my rats under one arm like a banker with flowers for the wife, and reading from streetlight to streetlight as I made my way into Chinatown. "Need more rat," said Uncle Ho. It only took me about 30 blocks of backtracks and zigzags before I found the opium den's red door. A big Chinese guy in traditional silk jacket and hat let me in and led me through the sickly sweet smoke to a back room where Uncle Ho sat drinking tea at a carved mahogany table under a red paper lantern over a bare bulb. I guess the fire marshal doesn't include opium dens on his rounds. I put my sack of rats on the table by Ho's tea. He opened the sack, untied the box, peeked in. That's when he said, "Need more rat." "You use those up, then I'll get more." Uncle Ho scrunched up his mug in disapproval until he looked like one of those dried-up faces you carve out of an apple in third grade to teach you that time is cruel and we are all just going to shrivel up and die. So there's no point in getting out of bed. Third grade was my broken heart year, so I may have absorbed a different lesson from the dried apple face than other kids did. That was the face Ho put on. "Need many rat to bring snake." "There are many rats in the alley out back. Have your gorilla go catch some." "Only white rat work." "That's malarkey," I said. "How do you know this anyway? You sure you're going to use these rats to catch a snake? Maybe you get a cat or two by accident, huh?" As soon as the word cat left my yap, I was aware that I had stepped deeply into dog shit, as far as Uncle Ho went. He gave me the dried apple face of scrutiny. "Brother Lai, I only play with cat." "Right, our animal fails. Who doesn't have a special animal friend as a kid?" I was shrugging so hard it looked like I was trying to sprout wings. "Bring more rat in the morning," said Ho. "Okie dokie," I said, "will do." I saluted, which I'm not sure is absolutely kosher in Chinese circles, so I bowed a couple of times too, just in case. "And take fat cop away in morning." "Uncle Ho," I was pleading. "I don't, Eddie doesn't." I was stumbling. I got nothing. What the hell were we going to do with Pookie O'Hara in the morning? Ever. I mean, Eddie and I discussed that we had no solution to the Pookie problem, but we hoped that something would occur to us before our rent on the opium bunk ran out. "Hey, Ho, we are paid up for 2 days. You said, morning," said Ho. He waved a hand to dismiss me, and the palooka and the silk jacket took my arm to make the point. "Those are first-rate funking rats," I added as I was escorted out the door. Chapter 14. Jukin to Jimmy's. I did the climb, 387 steps up, and half that down the other side. Back to Stilton's place, just to check. Maybe she came in. Nothing was moved except the note I'd left her. The note I signed, with my own name. What a dope. Someone had been there. But there was no sign it was the cheese. No clothes thrown around. The shower pan and sink were dry. I ran all over the triangle around City Hall, from Van Ness Avenue to Market Street to Golden Gate Avenue, that we call the Theater District. Actually, no one calls it that. And if someone does, it's because they are from out of town. Because it is the Tenderloin. But it also happens to contain most of the grand theaters in the city. And I peeked my head into every one, looking for a tuxedo and top hat review. Even asked around about a period play that might involve an actor dressed just so. But no dice. No one had seen such a thing since Gene Kelly was last in town, kicking high and tapping toes and whatnot. The Chronicle revealed no such review going on in the various clubs either, so I was left without direction for finding the cheese. I headed to Cookies in search of some tea and sympathy, or maybe a grilled cheese and scuttlebutt. Milo was manning his station, pouring shots and wishing Happy New Year to one and all. I joined him at the side of his cab. "Happy New Year," said Milo. "That is a very sharp suit, Sammy, very sharp indeed. But it does not disguise the sadness that leaks out of you at the various corners." "Yeah?" I asked. "Yeah," Milo replied. "May I buy you a cup of New Year's cheer to help bolster your spirits?" "That would be nice, Milo. Thanks." Milo caught the eye of the new waitress, Doris, who was no longer new, and signaled to her with an upraised digit, to which she inquired by pointing to me, to which Milo nodded. And lickety-split, Doris delivered a coffee with cream and two spoons of sugar to me at the curb, which was new. "That's new," Milo said. "Yeah, she is a swell broad, Doris. We have an arrangement." "An arrangement as in dividing the pie, or an arrangement as in hiding the banana?" "Alas," said Milo, "Doris has a few more years on her than I usually prefer in a broad, and reminds me a little of my mother. And besides, she is stubbornly married to a longshoreman, who I hear is easily sored up." "Alas," I sighed, "but her Java is top shelf. And just a snort short of perfect. And she does not bust my chops for not taking it black, which makes Doris a stand-up broad." Milo perfected my cup with a short pour from the pint under his jacket. "So?" Milo inquired. "So," I said. And here I considered my position before launching into the whole Megillah. Milo knew about Pookie, of course, because we had commandeered his cab for the kidnapping, and he knew we had him stashed somewhere. But he did not know about the snake, about my dead boss, or the strange guys in the black suits who were, apparently, shadowing me. So rather than endanger a pal with needless details, I quickly rehashed the Pookie situation and filled him in on my short and heartbreaking history with the cheese, wrapping up that I was distraught that I did not know where to find her. "Ah, James," Milo said, "I told you that one was daffy." And suddenly I was miffed that Milo had disparaged the cheese. "Milo, you don't know a thing about dames. I've never even seen you with a dame." Milo did not detect my ire, and replied in an academic manner. "Sammy," he said, "you'd be surprised at the number of dames who wouldn't turn a trick in a million years, but will bargain themselves into giving it up for cab fare when it's late and they want to get home." He was right. I was surprised. The circumstances of Milo's personal life had never occurred to me before. I always viewed him as a solo act, despite much talk of trim and making time that was passed among the gents leaning on the cab. I was suddenly struck with a horrifying suspicion. So I asked, "Milo, I know you said you know her. Did Stilton ever give it up for cab fare?" "Nah, she was a hard case. I offered to take her home from the Fillmore for a 5-count peep at her fun bags once, and she told me to jump up a monkey's ass." "That's my girl." I was so relieved I nearly poured out my coffee by accident. I said, "Guess she bargained you down some. Are you kidding? It would have been worth it. That broad had a great set of cans." "Has," I was thinking, "has a great set of cans." "Has," I said. Right then I would have given a year's pay to run my lips down the luscious canyon of her cleavage and drift a sweet oblivion in her arms. The cheese does indeed have a great set of cans on her. But Milo can't talk about her that way. "You are spinning yarns like a stiltskin, Milo. No dame ever offers you so much as a smooch on the cheek before you'd run her off the meter."
"No, they would. They do.
There are often offers of hand jobs and so forth. And here Milo removed his hat for the first time since I knew him, and I was surprised that he had quite a respectable head of dark hair. But it always involves driving. So then I'm nervous and in no mood for romance.
Romance?
Yeah, romance. Having a damn Yankee offer cab fare is romance? I'm a poet at heart, Sammy.
Yeah?
Me too. I would have given a year's pay to know she was safe, whoever's arm she was in. We both leaned back against the cab and stared wistfully into the diner, which was jumping with late-night merriment, but by the cab there was none. Milo finally said, "So you track her to her friend's place?"
"Right, maybe.
And the neighbor sees a skinny guy in tux and tails. But I've been to every show in town, and no one features a guy in tux and tails with stage makeup and red lips."
"Whoa, whoa, whoa," said Milo.
"Tux and tails and red lips?"
"Yeah, like I said, no one sees him."
"But you do not mention the red lips before, Sammy. The reason you can't find this guy is that he is not a guy. What you describe is an entertainer, but the show is at Jimmy's joint."
"Jimmy's joint?
And the Embarcadero?"
"I'd heard of it, but I did not know it."
"Yeah, it's a drag joint."
"Like Paper Dolls, like Finocchio's?"
Both were well-known drag show clubs that had been knocking it down in North Beach since the 30s. I'd been to Paper Dolls. They did it up large. Guys made up like Mae West and Sophie Tucker. Not lipstick in a suit.
"No, not like that," Milo said.
"Broads in drag, dressed like Sinatra, Fred Astaire, lady lovers."
"That's it.
Milo, how do I not know this? As a poet, perhaps a lot of practical knowledge gets by you."
"I gotta borrow your cab. I can't hoof it all the way to Telegraph Hill again."
"Nah, I need it to sleep in it. Kinda forgot to pay my rent this week. I'll drive you."
"But it's your busy time."
"Yeah," said Milo. "I can drop you off be back in two ticks. I'm not giving you a hand job."
"That's okay," said Milo.
"I'm a poet."
Jimmy Vasco liked vodka martinis, rare steaks, and leggy redheads. Jimmy had slick back, black hair, wore tux and tails, a diamond stick pin the size of a puppy's eye, and spats over patent leather tap shoes. Jimmy smoked Pall Malls in a long black holder, drove a 36 pearl black Ford coupe with a rumble seat, and when the occasion required, carried a German 380 automatic pistol. Jimmy could shoot pool like a shark, tap a toe like Bojangles, and croon a tune as smooth as Mel Torme. Jimmy was the owner and master of ceremonies at Jimmy's joint, just off the Embarcadero, and she was quite the dame. Milo told Sammy all of this while driving him through a chowder-thick fog to Jimmy's joint, a one-time warehouse on Pier 29. So Sammy was prepared and showed no surprise at all when he was greeted at the door by a broad in a double-breasted men's pinstripe suit, not unlike his own, but two sizes bigger and somewhat less rumpled.
"Good evening, sir," said the host.
"Welcome to Jimmy's joint. You on your own, or will friends be joining you?"
"Just me. Nice threads," Sammy said, eyeing the dame's suit.
"Thanks," she said. "Right back at you.
Can I find you a table, or maybe you want to find a spot at the bar? I'm afraid you've missed the last show."
"Well, actually," he paused, thinking ma'am, thinking miss, thinking maybe buddy. His experience with the lesbian community was somewhat limited, which is to say limited to what he had read in certain novels such as Gunslinger Gym Teachers of Lesbo Gulch, Jailhouse Sex Kittens in Heat, Little Women, and so forth.
"Butch," provided the door dame. Big grin, more friendly than challenging. This was her turf, and she tended to it with delight.
"Butch," Sammy said, returning the grin.
"I'm Sammy." He offered his hand to shake, and she gave it enough of a squeeze to strangle a beagle, in case he wondered how she came by her moniker, which he did not.
"I tend bar over at Sal's in North Beach. Not a classy joint like this. The liquor is watered and the clientele is mostly scum, but the long hours and bad tips make up for it."
Now Butch gave him a nod and a genuine smile. He was in the business.
"What can I do for you, Sammy?"
"I'm looking for a friend of mine. Friend of a friend, really. Someone saw her with a skinny guy with slick back black hair. Tailcoat, tux, and lipstick. Sound familiar?"
"Is friend of a friend of yours got a name?"
"Myrtle. I don't know her last name. Tallish redhead. She works at the dame I might be somewhat smitten with, who's gone missing. I just need to find out if she's okay."
Butch considered him for a moment, sussed out Sammy's vibe.
Take a seat at the end of the bar. Anyone comes in, flag down the bartender. Her name's Mel.
Butch moved through the club like a shark patrolling a reef, which is to say, with the smooth grace of knowing no one dares fuck with you. Sammy thought that Jimmy must be good at spotting talent, and he doubled down on the thought when Mel, the bartender, came over. She was a stunner. Tall, angular, and androgynous. Short blonde hair brushed up into a pompadour. She'd be a knockout in an evening dress at a cocktail party, and look just as good in a tux, escorting a Nob Hill broad to the opera. Tonight she was in the same togs Sammy wore to work. Black and whites, vest, garters on the sleeves. Except she wore a pearl choker, with an onyx teardrop under her open collar instead of a tie.
"Butch says to set you up," she said. "On the house. What can I get you?"
"Gimlet," Sammy said, and cringed a little like he was ordering up a memory. That first night at Stilton's when they drank gimlets mixed right in the bottle. "Beefeaters if you got it, but Welgian's fine too."
"Got it," said Mel.
As she made his drink, Sammy looked around. The place was dark now. Smoky, but it was a big room, with a runway stage. Lots of tinsel and shine on it. When the show was on, probably all you could see were the entertainers and the stage lights. But now we could see through the crepuscular haze where this was still a seaside warehouse. Ductwork and wiring painted black to disappear. Heavy pulleys and hooks hiding in the rafters. The carpet was dark red, matted with years of traffic and 1,000 slosh drinks. At the tables were mostly couples, talking soft, heads close together, dressed in suits and dresses, some wound up in each other's arms, others smoking and listening, and staring into each other's eyes over dying candles and half-finished cocktails. All women. One dame at a table by the stage, just like a guy, looked up from her girly partner to Sammy, and gave him an, "Are you looking for trouble, glare?" Sammy looked away. Not only was he not looking for trouble, but he did not know how to proceed with the dame if he found it, as his pop taught him that you must never hit a girl, especially your sister, even if she was being a pest. Butch returned from the back at the same time Sammy's drink arrived.
"Come with me," Butch said. "You can bring your drink."
Sammy flipped a tip in the bar with a toast to Mel over his shoulder as he followed Butch through the club to a discreet door behind a screen, down a short hallway, made of rough lumber painted blood red, to a black lacquered door marked private. Butch held the door for Sammy. He entered, found himself standing before an aircraft carrier desk made of some dark wood, walnut maybe, streamlined and trimmed out with bits of brass set into the wood, the finish around the rounded corners showing wear from countless thighs brushing past. Sammy figured the desk was about as old as he was, the dame behind it somewhat older. Jimmy Vasco stood up as Sammy entered. She was exactly as described by Milo and the Russian granny, except she was not wearing lipstick or tailcoat. But the tuck shirt was there, with French cuffs, held clothes with diamond-studded initials. J.V. She was shorter and older than Sammy expected. 5'2", maybe 40 years old. But she could pass for a younger guy.
"Jimmy. Jimmy Vasco," she said, offering her hand.
"Sammy Tiffin," Sammy said, shaking, looking her in the eye, the way his dad taught him, man to man. She smiled, a crooked smile, like she had something up her sleeve. She gestured for him to sit. He sat. She sat. She said,
"Sergeant O'Myrtle, down to business right away."
"I don't really, mister." He caught himself. Jimmy threw her head back and laughed, a full guffaw, then snorted and dismissed his discomfort with a wave. "It's okay. Just Jimmy. Come on." Sammy liked her on the spot. Since he had come to the city, he had become used to being the odd one out. But never was he put at ease so quickly. The thing Milo didn't tell him? Jimmy Vasco was a stand-up guy, kind of. He could see her sharing lies over spiked coffee and meatloaf with the guys at Cookies. "I barely know Myrtle," Sammy said. "Met her once. She works at the Five and Dime with the gal I've kind of been seeing, and they're both missing. As far as anyone can tell, anyway. I figure maybe they're together. I'm worried sick."
"And what brings you here?"
"Myrtle's neighbor lady sees someone looks a lot like you through the peephole. Picking up clothes and whatnot, I asked around." Jimmy nodded, fit a Paul Mall into a holder, and offered one to Sammy. He shook it off. She lit hers. She said,
"You know, Sammy, most of the time a guy shows up here looking for his girl, He's in store for a big surprise. Sometimes the girls go away with the guy. Claim was all a big mistake. They was just here for the show. Sometimes they stay. And sometimes it gets unpleasant and the gentleman is persuaded to leave.
That's not me, Sammy said.
So you got it bad for Stilton, do you?
You could say, he said. Jimmy nodded, smoked thoughtfully, blew a stream of smoke to the corner.
Mert, you want to come in here and help this poor mope out?
A louvered door over by some file cabinets opened, and out stepped the gangly redhead that was Myrtle. Gray slacks and a white silk blouse, heels. She kept her eyes to the floor and moved in tiny sidesteps over behind the desk next to Jimmy. Jimmy put a protective hand on her waist.
Hi, Sammy,
Myrtle said, still not looking up. Sammy looked from the door, which she hadn't noticed before, to Myrtle to the door.
Hi, Myrtle.
Then to Jimmy.
Is that a closet?
Jimmy burst out laughing, blasting a cloud of smoke and spittle over the desk. The laugh broke down into a cough. She gasped. After a second, she regained her composure, butted her cigarette in a marble ashtray, wiped a tear from her eye, and pulled Myrtle close, hugged her hip.
Ah, yes, Sammy, in a manner of speaking, I guess it is. But it is also my dressing room, and there's a bed and a shower back there. You know, club hours, you bunk where you can. But for Mert right now, that would be what we call the closet.
She gave Myrtle an affectionate squeeze at the waist. Myrtle looked down at the desk, mortified.
You gotta promise not to tell Tilly,
Myrtle said to Sammy.
She just shit.
She's not here then, Sammy said. When he saw Myrtle, he'd really hoped he'd found them both.
No, said Myrtle. I'm not sure where she is.
But you've seen her. The tone of her voice gave him a chill.
Tell him, Jimmy said.
Myrtle came around the desk like she was pleading a case to Sammy.
Tilly ain't no floozy. You shouldn't ought to think that. She was just trying to pick up a little folding money, and that douchebag guy, Sal, offered us $100 for one night. Actually, $50, but Tilly talked him up.
Sal Gabelli?
Yeah. Guy that owns that bar you work in. He comes on to me and Tilly last week at Vanessi's. Since if we go on this camp out up in Sonoma, he'll give us $100 apiece. All we have to do is be nice to some rich guys, maybe a little dancing. Nothing else, so we think, why not?
This the Bohemian Club thing? Sammy asked. It was all falling into place. Fucking Sal. He had thought the camp out was another of Sal's goofball plans, like the dog pizza.
Yeah, that's them. So Sal calls me, tells me he'll pick us up at my place. We're expecting a car, but it shows up as a bus, like a little bus, and there's a bunch of other girls on it. I don't know, 18, 20. All of them are scrubbed up like farm girls. No makeup or lipstick. Me and Tilly were just in our on-the-town duds, and I'll tell you, when we saw this bunch, we both felt like tramps. A lot of them were dressed like Dorothy from The Wizard of Oz. I don't know why. But then on the drive up, which takes an hour and a half, we find out that they aren't farm girls at all. They're all working girls from Mabel's.
Sammy raised a hand to stop her. Myrtle, where is Stilton?
I'm getting to that. Give me a second. So we get to this camp, and I gotta tell you, these guys have got to have some serious cheddar because they have some of the biggest trees I ever seen.
Dullface, Jimmy interjected. Strictly speaking, I don't think the size of the trees has anything to do with their income.
Jimmy gave Sammy a roll of the eyes. Dames, what are you going to do?
Stilton, Sammy said, bringing Myrtle back to the point.
So the bus driver gets stopped at the gate, and the guys at the gate get very stern about no dames in the camp. But the driver says, Alton Stoddard III. And I remember the name because it's like magic words, and the guys at the gate waved us through. Then the driver just dumps us off in this dirt parking lot in the woods. Don't get me wrong, they're nice woods, but all of a sudden we're just a bunch of girls, standing around waiting to get raped and murdered and whatnot.
Sammy cringed, and Myrtle dismissed his concern with the wave.
But it's fine. Pretty soon some guys in ranger shirts or something come down, and they go on about it being strictly no dames. Then one of the working girls, a tall, skinny gal like me, only blonde, called Pearl, says, Alton Stoddard III. Again with the magic words. Suddenly the ranger guys lead us up this little road to a dining hall with a kitchen, and there's chili cooking and other snacks, and guys bartending in white coats and so forth. The bartenders and the guys serving are from the city. The guys in the ranger shirts are country guys that live in those little towns up there in the Redwoods. But these local guys skedaddle, and the bartenders are very nervous about breaking the no-dames policy, even when Pearl says Alton started the third. They hustle us into a room behind the kitchen, which is their dining room. Suddenly, Tilly and I are happy we took our $100 up front, which sets off the working girls when we mention it, because they are not paid up front, or anywhere near $100. So, we are peeking through the crack in the door when the bohemians start coming in, and most of them are older guys, like banker types. But you can't tell, because they're all wearing work pants and stuff, though none of them looks like he's done a day of work in his life. Pretty soon they all have split up and taken off into campsites, and the bartenders tell us we should just relax until they consult with whoever brings us here. Well, none of them have ever heard of Sal, but they have heard of Alton Stoddard III. And Tilly says that it's a good thing, because she thinks if they don't, we might all be buried in a trench somewhere. She's a hoot. What a joker that girl is.
Here Myrtle leaned over the desk, so her face was even with Sammy's, and she said,
"At least, that is what I think at the time."
"Oh, hell," said Sammy, hopeless.
"Baby, don't do that," said Jimmy.
"What?"
"The drama, doll. Don't add the drama."
"It's how I tell a story."
"But Sammy here does not need the extra drama. Look at the poor guy. He's dramatized already. Also, he's probably already figured out that you do not end up buried in a trench in this story."
"Sorry, Sammy," Myrtle said demurely.
She came around the desk, sat in the chair next to him, patted his arm.
"There, there, sweetheart. Tilly is probably not dead in the trench."
"But you never know,"
said Jimmy, like a little ray of sunshine. Chapter 15. Let's say tax guys. Because he was a higher rank, Bailey got to take the feet and Hatch had to take the shoulders. When you're loading a cold, wet, dead Italian onto an airplane, the guy with the shoulders is going to get a lot wetter. Rank has its privileges. The only thing Bailey knew about Hatch, other than that they were roughly the same size physically, was that Hatch held a lower rank. He didn't know his real name, where he was from, or even if he was married, and he wasn't supposed to know. They belonged to an agency that was so new and so secret that it had failed its basic mission the day the second guy joined. So except for the immediate instructions for the mission, which they received from a monotone voice at the other end of a long-distance phone number, they knew nothing about each other. Until tonight, when they were instructed to meet two other agents and drop off the Italian, Bailey and Hatch thought they were the only members of the agency. Bailey was nervous about it. He didn't trust these other agents. He wasn't supposed to. The Chrysler was parked at the end of a deserted runway that was a Santa Rosa airport. About 20 yards from a DC-10 with Air Force markings, which is where they were taking the dead Italian. Sal Gabelli was frozen in a sitting position and had little chunks of ice clinging to his clothing. He streamed melted on the runway as they carried him.
"I can't wait until this is over and we can go back to hunting Nazis," Hat said.
"Commies," said Bailey.
"Yeah, that's what I meant, commies. Sorry. Old habits."
"Down," Bailey said. When they were under the left wing, they lowered the corpsicle to the ground. Hatch rubbed his hands together for warmth and tried to look through the passenger windows of the airplane.
"I can't see anything. Are they in there?"
Bailey looked over the top of his sunglasses. They had been issued the glasses and told to wear them at all times. Evidently, the subject might be capable of producing some kind of radiation that would burn the retina, and the glasses would protect them. Bailey sometimes took them off to sleep, which made him feel quite the rebel. Over the sunglasses, he could see the beam of a flashlight playing around the inside of the airplane. They were in there. They had to have heard the Chrysler pull up, the trunk open, Hatch yammering on like an auctioneer on truth serum about Nazis and sunglasses. Why didn't they come out? He fished a quarter out of his pocket and tapped it on the wing. The latch on the small door behind the wing turned, and the door swung open. A man in a black fedora knelt in the doorway and lowered a small set of stairs. Then came down them and joined them beside the melting Italian.
"Clarence," said the new agent.
He didn't offer his hand. He wore a black suit, a white shirt, thin black tie, and sunglasses.
"Bailey,"
Bailey said.
"Hatch," he said, pointing to Hatch.
Hatch touched the brim of his hat. Vestigial salute instinct. Bailey frowned at him.
"Everything in order?"
Bailey asked Clarence.
"Two on board."
"Dead?"
"Soon. Ether and pentothal. Enough fuel to get it to altitude, just need to get this one aboard."
"Just two?"
"The others are yours," said Clarence.
"Nothing else? They give you anything?"
Nothing. The general denied it all. He was indignant. The woman knew nothing.
Bailey was at an impasse. Clarence hadn't mentioned the subject. Did he not know that that was what he was looking for, why they were there? He could ask her what he knew, but then that would be tipping his hand that he knew more. Of course, he could lie. But was he supposed to? He didn't even know if Clarence outranked him.
"You have any leads on the others?"
Clarence asked.
"They may be holed up with a club owner named Jimmy Vasco," Bailey said. "We were on our way there when we called for orders at 00 hours.
"What about the subject?" Hatch asked. Bailey wanted to draw his